Will you turn to Revelation 12, 17, please? Revelation chapter 12, verse 16. I told you our text would be Revelation 12, but I changed my mind. It's going to be 12 and 13. This sermon is Holy War, part 1. Next week will be Holy War, part 2, on Revelation 14 and up to 15:4. It seemed better to put chapter 13 with 12 than to put 13 with 14 and 15. Revelation wants to answer this question. What is really going on in the world? What explains the hard things in the world? And what should we be doing? In particular, what explains that the world does not like Christians? In one verse, we get the answer of this whole holy war in chapter 12, verse 17. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. He went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring. We are those who keep God's commands and hold fast to our testimony about Jesus. That's us. We find ourselves in holy war because a great dark power declared war on us. We did not ask for war. We want to obey God and follow Christ. But that got us into war. For that very reason, a great power, a great dark power, declared war on us. And that is the world we live in. And everyone on the planet will either submit to the dragon or be at war with him. There are no other options. The closer we get to the end, the more evident that will be. Revelation was written to seven first century churches, and this same holy war was raging in their lives and in their cities. Revelation was to tell them what was really going on. So everything we cover today was real in their lives. So this is holy war in seven scenes. So chapter 12, verse 1, 12:1 to 15:4. So it's three chapters, 12, 13, 14, and a bit from chapter 15. These seven scenes are one more sequence in Revelation covering the whole time between Christ's first and second comings. Revelation does this repeatedly. We had it in the throne room vision, the seals, the 144,000 in the great multitude in chapter 7, the trumpets, and the two witnesses. This is the sixth time Revelation has covered the whole time between Christ's two comings, and there will be a few more. So Revelation 12 is scene 1. And scene 1 tells us why the dragon was enraged at the woman and why he declared war on God's people. How did this war come to be? That's what chapter 12 is. And this is important. Why he declared war on us is all good news for us. The war is not good news. But all the reasons why we got there is good news for us. God did good things for us, and that's why he's enraged. Most of chapter 12 is good news for us. Chapter 12 is scene 1. Revelation 13, 1 begins, and I saw. That'll be scene 2. And 13, 11 begins, and I saw, which is scene 3. And that's as far as we're going today. Our translations don't use the same word every time. But in Greek, it is, and I saw, exactly the same words, six more times after chapter 12. So chapter 12 is the first scene, and they're marked out fairly clearly for us in that way. The last one is the beginning of chapter 15. Preparing this sermon caused me distress, because I want to tell you what all the images mean, and I also want to show you how we know that. But we don't have nearly enough time for me to do that. And so for the most part today, we're looking at the forest and not the trees. And that is not my preference, but it's for your good, and there are still too many trees. A great sign appeared in heaven, 12:1. A woman clothed with the sun and with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain in the agony of giving birth. So the woman is the faithful people of God, faithful Israel and faithful church together. It's basically the same woman who is the bride of Christ at the wedding supper in Revelation 19. What in Revelation 19? There's one good woman in Revelation. She comes up in different forms. And the people of God want to give birth to their Savior. The woman wants to give birth to her champion, her Savior. So this means Israel is included in the woman because Israel produced Christ. And the words tell us this is a very difficult birth. I hear that they're not all the same. I'm no expert on this, but they're not all the same. This is a hard one. Verse 3, then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its heads. Its tail swept 1/3 of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. So this dragon is massive enough to sweep stars out of the sky, and he's hostile. He's destroying God's creation, fling stars to the earth. This could well be the angels that follow the dragon. If so, he's a lying bully like always, and they do not love him. The dragon has crowns on his head. He's a ruler. And he knows that if that woman's son survives, he's doomed. So he's waiting. Verse 5, she gave birth to a son, a male child who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The line about ruling all the nations is a Christ prediction from Psalm 2. So the child is Christ, we sort of knew that. And the whole life of Jesus is just a moment. He's born and God snatches him up and puts him on his throne. And that is very good news. The woman fled into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1260 days. So that's one of Daniel's paraphrases for 3.5 years, which will come up often. The 3.5 years, my brothers and sisters, started as soon as Christ ascended. Okay, the 3.5 years means a time of trouble, and it's the whole time between the comings. Those, it started as soon as he ascended. She flees to be safe for 3.5 years, and it had begun in the first century. The 3.5 years were going on in John's 7 churches. But the point is, the woman's champion is safe, and God also protects the woman, where she's a place prepared by God where she might be taken care of. So the woman's champion is safe. The dragon cannot destroy either the champion or the woman, the church. Good news. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Now we find out who the dragon is. It's the devil, also known as Satan, who was the serpent who led Adam and Eve down the wrong path. So he leads the whole world astray. So he's called a serpent because he's basically doing to the whole world what he did to Adam and Eve. That's his method. He's doing the same thing now everywhere. So there's war in heaven, and Satan and his angels were thrown down. This kind of thing comes up in the teaching of Jesus. In Mark 3, the Jewish leaders accused Jesus of casting out demons by the power of Satan. Jesus said, "You know that's impossible. Think about it, boys. It's not going to work." Then Jesus explained how to steal from a strong man. Here's how you steal from a strong man. You go into his house, and first you must overpower him and tie him up. Once you have tied him up, you can plunder his house, take what you want. That's how you steal from a strong man. And Jesus says, that is why I'm casting out demons. That's what Jesus has done with Satan already during his ministry. He has bound Satan and is plundering his house. He never tells us to bind Satan. He bound Satan. And now the disciples go out and can cast out demons because Jesus bound Satan. His followers plundered Satan's house, took what is the devil's, and made it God's. And that was Jesus' explanation for it. In Luke 10, the 70 disciples came back and joyfully told Jesus that even demons submit to them. Jesus said, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." It sounds like Revelation 12, doesn't it? Jesus acts like he has already defeated Satan during his earthly ministry. That's the way he talks. But the rest of the New Testament all acts like it happened at his death and resurrection. He triumphed over at that point. So, I don't know how to sort those out. One way or the other, the first coming of Christ brought a great victory over Satan, who is a real player in this all. Verse 10. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them before God, our God, day and night, has been hurled down." So, Christ's kingdom is already in place. That started with his first coming. The kingdom of God and the authority of the Messiah are already in place now. Revelation 1:5 said, "Jesus is the ruler of the kings of the earth. He has complete sovereignty over earth. He is not using it, but he's got it." Before Christ died, Satan accused God's people, God's faithful people that were with God. We're talking about Abraham and Jacob and David and people like that. They were sinners, but God had accepted them. And they're with God, and God's giving them his favor. And Satan is accusing them, and he's really accusing God for being unrighteous. "God, you say you're a holy God, and you have all these uncleansed sinners enjoying your eternal blessing. You are not a holy God." That's going on the whole time. But once Christ died and the Lamb was slaughtered, their sins were covered. They were freed from their sins by his blood. And Satan was silenced and expelled. And you can bet they were happy in heaven to get that voice out of there, because he'd been doing that day and night until that time. In John 12, after Jesus speaks of his coming death, he says, "Now the prince of this world will be driven out." Okay, so something massive happens with Satan at that point. Verse 11, "They triumphed over the dragon by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death." Now all of a sudden, it's not Christ who conquers Satan, the dragon, it's us. We're the ones given credit for his victory. How do we do that? The blood of the Lamb? Three things. The blood of the Lamb that bought us for God. Two, the word of our witness. Jesus is Lord of all, no matter what happens. Jesus is Lord of all, no matter what happens. And three, we'll die before we'll change our mind. By this, we conquer the dragon. "Therefore rejoice," verse 12, "you heavens and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short." When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle, so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness, where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. In Exodus, God took Israel out of Egypt and into the wilderness, out of Egypt's reach. In Exodus 19, when Israel got to Mount Sinai, God said this, "You yourselves have seen what I did to your enemies and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. When eagle chicks are falling, the parents catch them on their back and take them to where it's safe." That's God's picture. This is one of the nicest lines in the Bible. This is what God is going to say to us when we stand before him. "You yourselves have seen what I did to your enemies and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." That is the plot going underneath all of Revelation. That's where this ends up. Those same eagle's wings carry this woman into the wilderness where God will guard her for the time of trouble. So, look at this from the dragon's perspective. He failed to destroy the woman's son. He lost an angelic war. He's expelled from heaven. He can't touch any of his real enemies. So, he chased the woman. But God takes the woman, the church, to the wilderness out of the serpent's reach. He can't get to the woman. For 3.5 years of trouble, which is the whole time between the two comings of Christ, Satan cannot destroy the church. Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of death, the forces of death, will not overcome it. The church will last. Then from his mouth, the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Notice that in verse 15, he's not called the dragon, he's called the serpent again. That takes us back to Genesis 3. What comes out of the serpent's mouth in Genesis 3? Lies, slander, deceit. Okay? This the dragon still uses from outside the church and also inside the church. But it won't work. The earth is on our side. The woman is not destroyed. The lies and slander do cause serious trouble. Why do you think our world, especially now in our society, is so happy to list all the failures of the church? Many of which are true. But the church has done and is doing many good things. Nobody talks about that. Church is doing many good things right now and has over the years. There's a long history of great stuff. The world is much improved. Nobody talks about that. It's embarrassing to be a Christian because they list all our faults, many of which are true and they're serious. But nobody talks about the good stuff. That's the river of slander. Okay? It's out there. And we live where that's going around. Lots of it. But it will not destroy the church. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman because he can't get her either, and he went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. Listen, the dragon, that's how we got in war. The dragon cannot destroy Christ or God or God's angels or even the church. He's doomed and his time is short. The only thing he can do now is go after individual believers. And he does. And he does. That's how we got in holy war. That's how we got in holy war. And we are those who keep God's commands and hold fast to our confession that Jesus is Lord of all and has full rights to our lives. And that is how we got into holy war. We didn't ask for it. It came to us. That's how John's seven churches got into holy war. And how every follower of Christ gets into holy war. It's intense, but it comes out of a whole series of good news for us. You remember that. Scene 2. The shape of the war, a beast that demands worship. Chapter 13, verses 1 to 10. The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, 13:1, and I saw. That's the beginning of scene 2. And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, 10 crowns on its horns. Each head has a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but it had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. Counterfeit resurrection. Many counterfeits. The whole world was filled with wonder and followed the beast. The people worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast and they asked, who is like the beast? Who can wage war against it? Satan calls a monster out of the sea, but it's a land beast, a leopard, bear, lion. A marvelous, terrible creature. People worship the dragon and the beast, but not for love. Why? There's no point fighting it. Who could fight the beast? Some are suspicious, but they just give up. Can't fight this thing. Verse 5. God gives the beast a leash. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies, and it was given authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to blaspheme God, to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against the saints and conquer them. It was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. It was given power to wage war against the saints and to conquer them. When we talked about the two witnesses in chapter 11, that's exactly the same line. The beast was given power to do that to the two witnesses. That's one of the reasons the two witnesses are just a picture of the whole church being faithful to Christ. So, it has authority for 42 months. That's the 3.5 years. In the first century, the beast was Caesar. And the churches recognized that right away. Caesars insisted on emperor worship because they thought it would reduce rebellion. That's why they did it. Did not think they were gods. They were paranoid. And they thought, if you make people worship me, worship an idol of me, it will reduce rebellion. Caesar had a lot of authority. But was given occurs 4 times here. This means given by God. The beast is on a leash. God holds the leash. And God, for his own reasons, permits this. He has not lost control, though it will seem that way. And there's a time limit. 3.5 years, a designated time of trouble, and then he reels in the leash and it's over. There's a warning to the saints in verses 9 and 10. The beast means trouble. Listen, brothers and sisters, whoever has ears, let them hear. If anyone is to go into captivity they will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword, they will be killed with the sword. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. This is not ambiguous. Okay, this is where this goes. Let us resolve to endure and stay faithful to God. That's what he's calling for. Let us resolve to endure and stay faithful to God. Scene 3, a second beast who's the first beast's enforcer. And I saw a second beast, verse 11, coming out of the earth. 2 horns like a lamb, more counterfeit. It spoke like a dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed, counterfeit resurrection. And it performed great signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to the earth in full view of the people. Because of the signs it was given power to perform on behalf of the first beast, it deceived the inhabitants of the earth. It ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. The second beast was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that the image could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. So this is back to Daniel's 3 friends in Daniel. I already said that. Daniel's 3 friends in Babylon, and the big they're supposed to worship this thing and they will not worship, and so they're thrown into the furnace and so on. This is kind of like that kind of a picture. In every city, the Roman government set up a statue of Caesar. And people needed to come once in a while and bring an offering and worship there. Say the right things and your name would be checked off of a list. And the only reason people would not do that in the minds of the government was if you were traitors or spies. That's not why the Christians refused. Their God would not let them worship another God, but the Christians did refuse, and Revelation absolutely insists that the Christians refuse to do that. So the local government was loyal to Caesar, of course, and so Christians were treated severely. That's going on in the first century. And there's teaching in the church that it's okay, it doesn't really matter. You can do that to Caesar and still worship God. And Revelation says, no, you cannot. You will worship only God. The first beast is Caesar and the central power in Rome. The second beast is some kind of local enforcer. John's 7 churches in Asia did not have trouble figuring this out. They had to bow in front of Caesar's image, and if they did not bow, death was a very real possibility. They were living in this. It also forced all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands of their forehead, so they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. In the Roman world, every trade had a sort of a brotherhood, a workers' union. So if you are a builder, or a truck driver, or you're a computer technician, you would belong to this. And these brothers had meals together, and the meal was celebration of an idol, a certain god, and the 8 meals of offering to the idol. This happened in Corinth. Flee from idolatry, Paul wrote. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. So, but if you don't, you can't buy or sell. How are you going to be a builder or a trucker if you don't belong to the city union? So there were immediate economic implications if you were going to worship only Christ. Worshiping only God can block economic survival. That is an old story, and I've heard it from people in this church and outside of this church. Verse 18. This calls for wisdom. That the person who has insight calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of man. The number is 666. The number of the beast. The line says it is the number of a man. In Greek, how you say the number of a man and the number of man are exactly the same. You have to decide from context. Nothing in chapter 13 has told us that the beast is human. Until the last verse of Revelation 13, he's a leopard bear lion that comes out of the sea. What does the number tell us? Human, human, human. Number 6 is the human number because people were made on the 6th day. That's good. People were made in the image of likeness of God. 6 is not a bad number. It's a good number. But in the very next verse, in chapter 14, God's people have God's name and the Lamb's name on our forehead. That's who we worship. The point of 666 is not to identify a particular man. It's to identify the species of the beast. He's human. He's just human, for goodness sake. Why would you worship a human? 666, it's the number of humans. Human, human, human. And everybody, we have God's name and the Lamb's name on our foreheads. And everybody who worships the beast has human, human, human on the forehead. Why would you worship a human? He's made in the image of God just like we are. And you'll worship an image of the image of God. Okay? That's the point here. This doesn't make any sense. He's human. He's just a human. God's mark on his people, the name on our foreheads, it's not visible to the world, is it? Nothing on our foreheads for people to see. Why would the beast's mark be any more visible than God's? But it's not evident to me that there's anything actually marked on people's foreheads. Okay. That's the mark of the beast. We're concluding now. The dragon declared war on those who keep God's commands and who are faithful to Jesus. We're not his real enemy. He's already been defeated by his real enemy. And I will pause for a moment. Oh, thank you. We're not his real enemy, but he's been defeated by his real enemy. And for this time, which seems long to us, individual believers are the only target he can access. He's furious because of all his other losses. We are the only target he can reach. And he's doing best to force us to leave our faithfulness to God and worship authorities that he has placed. That's what he's doing. And so we shall worship God. Paul says, take your stand against the devil's schemes. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, against the powers of this dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Let us keep God's commands and be faithful to Jesus. The one who called us is faithful, and he will do it. Amen.